At each such division, the number shrinks colossally. Yet even with the most conservative inputs, the number of advanced civilizations just in the Milky Way always works out to be somewhere in the millions. What an interesting and exciting thought. We may be only one of millions of advanced civilizations. Unfortunately, space being spacious, the average distance between any two of these civilizations is reckoned to be at least 200 light-years, which is a great deal more than merely saying it makes it sound. It means, for a start, that even if these beings know we are here, and are somehow able to see us in their telescopes, they're watching light that left Earth 200 years ago. So they're not seeing you and me. They're watching the French Revolution, and Thomas Jefferson, and people in silk stockings and powdered wigs, people who don't know what an atom is, or a gene, and who make their electricity by rubbing a rod of amber with a piece of fur, and think that's quite a trick. Any message we receive from them is likely to begin, "Dear Sire," and congratulate us on the handsomeness of our horses and our mastery of whale oil. 200 light-years is a distance so far beyond us as to be, well, just beyond us. So even if we are not really alone, in all practical terms, we are. Carl Sagan calculated the number of probable planets in the universe at large at 10 billion trillion, a number vastly beyond imagining. But what is equally beyond imagining is the amount of space through which they are likely scattered. "If we were randomly inserted into the universe," Sagan wrote, "the chances that you would be on or near a planet would be less than 1 in a billion trillion trillion, that's 10^33, or a 1 followed by 33 zeros. Worlds are precious." Which is why perhaps it is good news that in February 1999 the International Astronomical Union ruled officially that Pluto is a planet. The universe is a big and lonely place. We can do with all the neighbors we can get. 3. The Reverend Evans's Universe. When the skies are clear and the moon is not too bright, the Reverend Robert Evans, a quiet and cheerful man, lugs a bulky telescope onto the back deck of his home in the Blue Mountains of Australia, about 50 miles west of Sydney, and does an extraordinary thing. He looks deep into the past and finds dying stars. Looking into the past is, of course, the easy part. Glance at the night sky, and what you see is history, and lots of it. The stars are not as they are now, but as they were when their light left them. For all we know, the North Star, our faithful companion, might actually have burned out last January, or in 1854, or at any time since the early 14th century, and news of it just hasn't reached us yet. The best we can say, can ever say, is that it was still burning on this date 680 years ago. Stars die all the time. What Bob Evans does better than anyone else who has ever tried is spot these moments of celestial farewell. By day, Evans is a kindly and now semi-retired minister in the Uniting Church in Australia, who does a bit of freelance work and researches the history of 19th-century religious movements. But by night he is, in his unassuming way, a titan of the skies. He hunts supernovae. Supernovae occur when a giant star, one much bigger than our own sun, collapses, and then spectacularly explodes, releasing in an instant the energy of 100 billion suns, burning for a time brighter than all the stars in its galaxy. "It's like a trillion hydrogen bombs going off at once," says Evans. If a supernova explosion happened within 500 light-years of us, we would be goners, according to Evans. "It would wreck the show," as he cheerfully puts it. But the universe is vast, and supernovae are normally much too far away to harm us. In fact, most are so unimaginably distant that their light reaches us as no more than the faintest twinkle. For the month or so that they are visible, all that distinguishes them from the other stars in the sky is that they occupy a point of space that wasn't filled before. It is these anomalous, very occasional pricks in the crowded dome of the night sky that the Reverend Evans finds. To understand what a feat this is, Imagine a standard dining room table, covered in a black tablecloth, and someone throwing a handful of salt across it. The scattered grains can be thought of as a galaxy. Now imagine 1,500 more tables like the first one, enough to fill a Walmart parking lot, say, or to make a single line 2 miles long, each with a random array of salt across it. Now, add one grain of salt to any table, and let Bob Evans walk among them. At a glance, he will spot it. That grain of salt is the supernova. Evans's is a talent so exceptional that Oliver Sacks, in An Anthropologist on Mars, devotes a passage to him in a chapter on autistic savants, quickly adding that there is no suggestion that he is autistic. Evans, who has not met Sacks, laughs at the suggestion that he might be either autistic or a savant, but he is powerless to explain quite where his talent comes from. "I just seem to have a knack for memorizing star fields," he told me, with a frankly apologetic look, when I visited him and his wife Elaine in their picture-book bungalow on a tranquil edge of the village of Hazelbrook, out where Sydney finally ends and the boundless Australian bush begins. "I'm not particularly good at other things," he added. "I don't remember names well." "Or where he's put things," called Elaine from the kitchen. He nodded frankly again and grinned, then asked me if I'd like to see his telescope. I had imagined that Evans would have a proper observatory in his backyard, a scaled-down version of a Mount Wilson or Palomar, with a sliding domed roof and a mechanized chair that would be a pleasure to maneuver. In fact, he led me not outside, but to a crowded storeroom off the kitchen, where he keeps his books and papers, and where his telescope, a white cylinder that is about the size and shape of a household hot water tank, rests in a homemade swiveling plywood mount. When he wishes to observe, he carries them in two trips to a small deck off the kitchen. Between the overhang of the roof and the feathery tops of eucalyptus trees growing up from the slope below, he has only a letterbox view of the sky, but he says it is more than good enough for his purposes. And there, when the skies are clear and the moon not too bright, he finds his supernovae. The term supernova was coined in the 1930s by a memorably odd astrophysicist named Fritz Zwicky. Born in Bulgaria and raised in Switzerland, Zwicky came to the California Institute of Technology in the 1920s, and there at once distinguished himself by his abrasive personality and erratic talents. He didn't seem to be outstandingly bright, and many of his colleagues considered him little more than an irritating buffoon. A fitness buff, he would often drop to the floor of the Caltech dining hall or other public areas and do one-armed push-ups to demonstrate his virility to anyone who seemed inclined to doubt it. He was notoriously aggressive. His manner eventually became so intimidating that his closest collaborator, a gentleman named Walter Bard, refused to be left alone with him. Among other things, Zwicky accused Bard, who was German, of being a Nazi, which he was not. On at least one occasion, Zwicky threatened to kill Bader, who worked up the hill at the Mount Wilson Observatory, if he saw him on the Caltech campus. But Zwicky was also capable of insights of the most startling brilliance. In the early 1930s, he turned his attention to a question that had long troubled astronomers, the appearance in the sky of occasional unexplained points of light, new stars. Improbably, he wondered if the neutron, the subatomic particle that had just been discovered in England by James Chadwick and was thus both novel and rather fashionable, might be at the heart of things. It occurred to him that if a star collapsed to the sort of densities found in the core of atoms, the result would be an unimaginably compacted core. Atoms would literally be crushed together, their electrons forced into the nucleus, forming neutrons. You would have a neutron star. Imagine a million really weighty cannonballs squeezed down to the size of a marble and, well, you're still not even close. The core of a neutron star is so dense that a single spoonful of matter from it would weigh 200 billion pounds. A spoonful. But there was more. Zwicky realized that after the collapse of such a star, there would be a huge amount of energy left over, enough to make the biggest bang in the universe. He called these resultant explosions supernovae. They would be, they are, the biggest events in creation. On January the 15th, 1934, the journal Physical Review published a very concise abstract of a presentation that had been conducted by Zwicky and Bader the previous month at Stanford University. Despite its extreme brevity, one paragraph of 24 lines, the abstract contained an enormous amount of new science. It provided the first reference to supernovae and to neutron stars, convincingly explained their method of formation, correctly calculated the scale of their explosiveness, and, as a kind of concluding bonus, connected supernova explosions to the production of a mysterious new phenomenon called cosmic rays, which had recently been found swarming through the universe. These ideas were revolutionary, to say the least. Neutron stars wouldn't be confirmed for 34 years. The cosmic rays notion, though considered plausible, hasn't been verified yet. Altogether, the abstract was, in the words of Caltech astrophysicist Kip S. Thorne, one of the most prescient documents in the history of physics and astronomy. Interestingly, Zwicky had almost no understanding of why any of this would happen. According to Thorne, he did not understand the laws of physics well enough to be able to substantiate his ideas. Zwicky's talent was for big ideas. Others, Bader mostly, were left to do the mathematical sweeping up. Zwicky also was the first to recognize that there wasn't nearly enough visible mass in the universe to hold galaxies together, and that there must be some other gravitational influence, what we now call dark matter. One thing he failed to see was that if a neutron star shrank enough, it would become so dense that even light couldn't escape its immense gravitational pull. You would have a black hole. Unfortunately, Zwicky was held in such disdain by most of his colleagues that his ideas attracted almost no notice. When, 5 years later, the great Robert Oppenheimer turned his attention to neutron stars in a landmark paper, he made not a single reference to any of Zwicky's work, even though Zwicky had been working for years on the same problem in an office just down the hall. Zwicky's deductions concerning dark matter wouldn't attract serious attention for nearly 4 decades. We can only assume that he did a lot of push-ups in this period. Surprisingly little of the universe is visible to us when we incline our heads to the sky. Only about 6,000 stars are visible to the naked eye from Earth, and only about 2,000 can be seen from any one spot. With binoculars, the number of stars you can see from a single location rises to about 50,000. And with a small 2-inch telescope, it leaps to 300,000. With a 16-inch telescope, such as Evans uses, you begin to count not in stars, but in galaxies. From his deck, Evans supposes he can see between 50,000 and 100,000 galaxies, each containing tens of billions of stars. These are, of course, respectable numbers, but even with so much to take in, supernovae are extremely rare. A star can burn for billions of years, but it dies just once, and quickly, and only a few dying stars explode. Most expire quietly, like a campfire at dawn. In a typical galaxy, consisting of 100 billion stars, a supernova will occur on average once every 200 or 300 years. Finding a supernova, therefore, was a little bit like standing on the observation platform of the Empire State Building with a telescope and searching windows around Manhattan in the hope of finding, let us say, someone lighting a 21st birthday cake. So when a hopeful and soft-spoken minister got in touch to ask if they had any usable field charts for hunting supernovae, the astronomical community thought he was out of his mind. At the time, Evans had a 10-inch telescope, a very respectable size for amateur stargazing, but hardly the sort of thing with which to do serious cosmology, and he was proposing to find one of the universe's rarer phenomena. In the whole of astronomical history before Evans started looking in 1980, fewer than 60 supernovae had been found. At the time I visited him, in August of 2001, he had just recorded his 34th visual discovery. A 35th followed 3 months later, and a 36th in early 2003. Evans, however, had certain advantages. Most observers, like most people generally, are in the northern hemisphere, so he had a lot of sky largely to himself, especially at first. He also had speed and his uncanny memory. Large telescopes are cumbersome things, and much of their operational time is consumed with being maneuvered into position. Evans could swing his little 16-inch telescope around like a tail gunner in a dogfight, spending no more than a couple of seconds on any particular point in the sky. In consequence, he could observe perhaps 400 galaxies in an evening, while a large professional telescope would be lucky to do 50 or 60. Looking for supernovae is mostly a matter of not finding them. From 1980 to 1996, he averaged 2 discoveries a year. Not a huge payoff for hundreds of nights of peering and peering. Once he found 3 in 15 days. But another time he went 3 years without finding any at all. "There is actually a certain value in not finding anything," he said. "It helps cosmologists to work out the rate at which galaxies are evolving. It's one of those rare areas where the absence of evidence is evidence." On a table beside the telescope were stacks of photos and papers relevant to his pursuits, and he showed me some of them now. If you have ever looked through popular astronomical publications, and at some time you must have, you will know that they are generally full of richly luminous colour photos of distant nebulae and the like, fairy-lit clouds of celestial light of the most delicate and moving splendour. Evans's working images are nothing like that. They are just blurry, black-and-white photos with little points of haloed brightness. One, he showed me, depicted a swarm of stars with a trifling flare that I had to put close to my face to see. This, Evans told me, was a star in a constellation called Fornax from a galaxy known to astronomy as NGC 1365. NGC stands for New General Catalogue, where these things are recorded. Once it was a heavy book on someone's desk in Dublin. Today, needless to say, it's a database. For 60 million silent years, the light from the star's spectacular demise travelled unceasingly through space, until one night, in August of 2001, it arrived at Earth, in the form of a puff of radiance, the tiniest brightening in the night sky. It was, of course, Robert Evans on his eucalypt-scented hillside who spotted it. "There's something satisfying, I think," Evans said, "about the idea of light travelling for millions of years through space, and just at the right moment, as it reaches Earth, someone looks at the right bit of sky and sees it. It just seems right that an event of that magnitude should be witnessed." Supernovae do much more than simply impart a sense of wonder. They come in several types, one of them discovered by Evans, and of these one in particular, known as a 1A supernova, is important to astronomy because it always explodes in the same way, with the same critical mass. For this reason it can be used as a standard candle to measure the expansion rate of the universe. In 1987, Saul Perlmutter, at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab in California, needing more 1A supernovae than visual sightings were providing, set out to find a more systematic method of searching for them. Perlmutter devised a nifty system using sophisticated computers and charge-coupled devices, in essence, really good digital cameras. It automated supernova hunting. Telescopes could now take thousands of pictures and let a computer detect the telltale bright spots that marked a supernova explosion. In 5 years, with the new technique, Perlmutter and his colleagues at Berkeley found 42 supernovae. Now even amateurs are finding supernovae with charge-coupled devices. "With CCDs you can aim a telescope at the sky and go watch television," Evans said with a touch of dismay. "It took all the romance out of it." I asked him if he was tempted to adopt the new technology. "Oh, no," he said. "I enjoy my way too much. Besides," he gave a nod at the photo of his latest supernova and smiled, "I can still beat them sometimes." The question that naturally occurs is, what would it be like if a star exploded nearby? Our nearest stellar neighbour, as we have seen, is Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light-years away. I had imagined that if there were an explosion there, we would have 4.3 years to watch the light of this magnificent event spreading across the sky, as if tipped from a giant can. What would it be like if we had 4 years and 4 months to watch an inescapable doom advancing toward us, knowing that when it finally arrived it would blow the skin right off our bones? Would people still go to work? Would farmers plant crops? Would anyone deliver them to the stores? Weeks later, back in the town in New Hampshire where I live, I put these questions to John Thorstenson, an astronomer at Dartmouth College. "Oh, no," he said, laughing. "The news of such an event travels out at the speed of light, but so does the destructiveness. So you'd learn about it and die from it in the same instant. But don't worry, because it's not going to happen." "For the blast of a supernova explosion to kill you," he explained, "you would have to be ridiculously close, probably within 10 light-years or so. The danger would be various types of radiation, cosmic rays, and so on. These would produce fabulous auroras, shimmering curtains of spooky light that would fill the whole sky. This would not be a good thing. Anything potent enough to put on such a show could well blow away the magnetosphere, the magnetic zone high above the Earth that normally protects us from ultraviolet rays and other cosmic assaults. Without the magnetosphere, anyone unfortunate enough to step into sunlight would pretty quickly take on the appearance of, let us say, an overcooked pizza. The reason we can be reasonably confident that such an event won't happen in our corner of the galaxy," Thorstenson said, "is that it takes a particular kind of star to make a supernova in the first place. A candidate star must be 10 to 20 times as massive as our own sun, and we don't have anything of the requisite size that's that close. The universe is a mercifully big place." "The nearest likely candidate," he added, "is Betelgeuse, whose various sputterings have for years suggested that something interestingly unstable is going on there. But Betelgeuse is 50,000 light-years away. Only 6 times in recorded history have supernovae been close enough to be visible to the naked eye. One was a blast in 1054 that created the Crab Nebula. Another, in 1604, made a star bright enough to be seen during the day for over 3 weeks. The most recent was in 1987, when a supernova flared in a zone of the cosmos known as the Large Magellanic Cloud, but that was only barely visible, and only in the southern hemisphere, and it was a comfortably safe 169,000 light-years away. Supernovae are significant to us in one other decidedly central way. Without them, we wouldn't be here. You will recall the cosmological conundrum with which we ended the first chapter, that the Big Bang created lots of light, gases, but no heavy elements. Those came later, but for a very long time nobody could figure out how they came later. The problem was that you needed something really hot, hotter even than the middle of the hottest stars, to forge carbon and iron and the other elements, without which we would be distressingly immaterial. Supernovae provided the explanation, and it was an English cosmologist, almost as singular in manner as Fritz Zwicky, who figured it out. He was a Yorkshireman named Fred Hoyle. Hoyle, who died in 2001, was described in an obituary in Nature as a cosmologist and controversialist, and both of those he most certainly was. He was, according to Nature's obituary, embroiled in controversy for most of his life, and put his name to much rubbish. He claimed, for instance, and without evidence, that the Natural History Museum's treasured fossil of an Archaeopteryx was a forgery along the lines of the Piltdown hoax, causing much exasperation to the museum's paleontologists, who had to spend days fielding phone calls from journalists from all over the world. He also believed that Earth was not only seeded by life from space, but also by many of its diseases, such as influenza and bubonic plague, and suggested at one point that humans evolved projecting noses with the nostrils underneath as a way of keeping cosmic pathogens from falling into them. It was he who coined the term Big Bang in a moment of facetiousness for a radio broadcast in 1952. He pointed out that nothing in our understanding of physics could account for why everything, gathered to a point, would suddenly and dramatically begin to expand. Hoyle favoured a steady-state theory in which the universe was constantly expanding and continually creating new matter as it went. Hoyle also realised that if stars imploded, they would liberate huge amounts of heat, 100 million degrees or more, enough to begin to generate the heavier elements in a process known as nucleosynthesis. In 1957, working with others, Hoyle showed how the heavier elements were formed in supernova explosions. For this work, W.A. Fowler, one of his collaborators, received a Nobel Prize. Hoyle, shamefully, did not. According to Hoyle's theory, an exploding star would generate enough heat to create all the new elements and spray them into the cosmos, where they would form gaseous clouds, the interstellar medium, as it is known, that could eventually coalesce into new solar systems. With the new theories, it became possible at last to construct plausible scenarios for how we got here. What we now think we know is this. About 4.6 billion years ago, a great swirl of gas and dust, some 15 billion miles across, accumulated in space where we are now and began to aggregate. Virtually all of it, 99.9% of the mass of the solar system, went to make the sun. Out of the floating material that was left over, two microscopic grains floated close enough together to be joined by electrostatic forces. This was the moment of conception for our planet. All over the inchoate solar system, the same was happening. Colliding dust grains formed larger and larger clumps. Eventually, the clumps grew large enough to be called planetesimals. As these endlessly bumped and collided, they fractured or split or recombined in endless random permutations. But in every encounter, there was a winner, and some of the winners grew big enough to dominate the orbit around which they traveled. It all happened remarkably quickly. To grow from a tiny cluster of grains to a baby planet, some hundreds of miles across, is thought to have taken only a few tens of thousands of years. In just 200 million years, possibly less, the Earth was essentially formed, though still molten and subject to constant bombardment from all the debris that remained floating about. At this point, about 4.5 billion years ago, an object the size of Mars crashed into Earth, blowing out enough material to form a companion sphere, the Moon. Within weeks, it is thought, the flung material had reassembled itself into a single clump, and within a year it had formed into the spherical rock that companions us yet. Most of the lunar material, it is thought, came from the Earth's crust, not its core, which is why the Moon has so little iron, while we have a lot. The theory, incidentally, is almost always presented as a recent one, but in fact it was first proposed in the 1940s by Reginald Daly of Harvard. The only recent thing about it is people paying any attention to it. When Earth was only about a third of its eventual size, it was probably already beginning to form an atmosphere, mostly of carbon dioxide, nitrogen, methane, and sulfur. Hardly the sort of stuff that we would associate with life, and yet from this noxious stew, life formed. Carbon dioxide is a powerful greenhouse gas. This was a good thing, because the sun was significantly dimmer back then. Had we not had the benefit of a greenhouse effect, the Earth might well have frozen over permanently, and life might never have gotten a toehold. But somehow, life did. For the next 500 million years, the young Earth continued to be pelted relentlessly by comets, meteorites, and other galactic debris, which brought water to fill the oceans and the components necessary for the successful formation of life. It was a singularly hostile environment, and yet somehow life got going. Some tiny bag of chemicals twitched and became animate. We were on our way. 4 billion years later, people began to wonder how it had all happened, and it is there that our story next takes us. Part 2. The Size of the Earth. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, "Let Newton be," and all was light. Alexander Pope. 4. The Measure of Things. If you had to select the least convivial scientific field trip of all time, you could certainly do worse than the French Royal Academy of Sciences' Peruvian expedition of 1735. Led by a hydrologist named Pierre Bouguer and a soldier mathematician named Charles-Marie de la Condamine, it was a party of scientists and adventurers who travelled to Peru with the purpose of triangulating distances through the Andes. At the time, people had lately become infected with a powerful desire to understand the Earth, to determine how old it was, and how massive, where it hung in space, and how it had come to be. The French party's goal was to help settle the question of the circumference of the planet by measuring the length of 1 degree of meridian, or 1/360th of the distance around the planet, along a line reaching from Yaroqui, near Quito, to just beyond Cuenca, in what is now Ecuador, a distance of about 200 miles. Triangulation, their chosen method, was a popular technique based on the geometric fact that if you know the length of one side of a triangle and the angles of two corners, you can work out all its other dimensions without leaving your chair. Suppose, by way of example, that you and I decided we wished to know how far it is to the moon. Using triangulation, the first thing we must do is to put some distance between us. So, let us say for argument that you stay in Paris and I go to Moscow, and we both look at the moon at the same time. Now, if you imagine a line connecting the three principles of this exercise, that is, you and I and the moon, it forms a triangle. Measure the length of the baseline between you and me, and the angles of our two corners, and the rest can be simply calculated. Because the interior angles of a triangle always add up to 180 degrees, if you know the sum of two of the angles, you can instantly calculate the third, and knowing the precise shape of a triangle and the length of one side tells you the lengths of the other sides. This was, in fact, the method used by a Greek astronomer, Hipparchus of Nicaea, in 150 BC, to work out the moon's distance from Earth. At ground level, the principles of triangulation are the same, except that the triangles don't reach into space, but rather are laid side to side on a map. In measuring a degree of meridian, the surveyors would create a sort of chain of triangles marching across the landscape. Almost at once, things began to go wrong, sometimes spectacularly so. In Quito, the visitors somehow provoked the locals and were chased out of town by a mob armed with stones. Soon after, the expedition's doctor was murdered in a misunderstanding over a woman. The botanist became deranged. Others died of fevers and falls. The third most senior member of the party, a man named Pierre Godin, ran off with a 13-year-old girl and could not be induced to return. At one point, the group had to suspend work for 8 months, while La Condamine rode off to Lima to sort out a problem with their permits. Eventually, he and Bouguer stopped speaking and refused to work together. Everywhere the dwindling party went, it was met with the deepest suspicions from officials who found it difficult to believe that a group of French scientists would travel halfway around the world to measure the world. That made no sense at all. 2.5 centuries later, it still seems a reasonable question. Why didn't the French make their measurements in France and save themselves all the bother and discomfort of their Andean adventure? The answer lies partly with the fact that 18th-century scientists, the French in particular, seldom did things simply if an absurdly demanding alternative was available, and partly with a practical problem that had first arisen with the English astronomer Edmund Halley many years before, long before Bouguer and La Condamine dreamed of going to South America, much less had a reason for doing so. Halley was an exceptional figure. In the course of a long and productive career, he was a sea captain, a cartographer, a professor of geometry at the University of Oxford, deputy controller of the Royal Mint, astronomer royal, and inventor of the deep-sea diving bell. He wrote authoritatively on magnetism, tides, and the motions of the planets, and fondly on the effects of opium. He invented the weather map and actuarial table, proposed methods for working out the age of the Earth and its distance from the sun, even devised a practical method for keeping fish fresh out of season. The one thing he didn't do, interestingly enough, was discover the comet that bears his name. He merely recognized that the comet he saw in 1682 was the same one that had been seen by others in 1456, 1531, and 1607. It didn't become Halley's Comet until 1758, some 16 years after his death. For all his achievements, however, Halley's greatest contribution to human knowledge may simply have been to take part in a modest scientific wager with two other worthies of his day. Robert Hooke, who is perhaps best remembered now as the first person to describe a cell, and the great and stately Sir Christopher Wren, who was actually an astronomer first and architect second, though that is not often generally remembered now. In 1683, Halley, Hooke, and Wren were dining in London when the conversation turned to the motions of celestial objects. It was known that planets were inclined to orbit in a particular kind of oval, known as an ellipse, a very specific and precise curve, to quote Richard Feynman, but it wasn't understood why. Wren generously offered a prize worth 40 shillings, equivalent to a couple of weeks' pay, to whichever of the men could provide a solution. Hook, who was well known for taking credit for ideas that weren't necessarily his own, claimed that he had solved the problem already, but declined now to share it, on the interesting and inventive grounds that it would rob others of the satisfaction of discovering the answer for themselves. He would instead conceal it for some time, that others might know how to value it. If he thought any more on the matter, he left no evidence of it. Halley, however, became consumed with finding the answer, to the point that the following year he travelled to Cambridge and boldly called upon the university's Lucasian professor of mathematics, Isaac Newton, in the hope that he could help. Newton was a decidedly odd figure, brilliant beyond measure, but solitary, joyless, prickly to the point of paranoia, famously distracted. Upon swinging his feet out of bed in the morning, he would reportedly sometimes sit for hours, immobilized by the sudden rush of thoughts to his head, and capable of the most riveting strangeness. He built his own laboratory, the first at Cambridge, but then engaged in the most bizarre experiments. Once he inserted a bodkin, a long needle of the sort used for sewing leather, into his eye socket and rubbed it around, betwixt my eye and the bone, as near to the back side of my eye as I could, just to see what would happen. What happened, miraculously, was nothing, at least nothing lasting. On another occasion he stared at the sun for as long as he could bear, to determine what effect it would have upon his vision. Again he escaped lasting damage, though he had to spend some days in a darkened room before his eyes forgave him. Set atop these odd beliefs and quirky traits, however, was the mind of a supreme genius, though even when working in conventional channels he often showed a tendency to peculiarity. As a student, frustrated by the limitations of conventional mathematics, he invented an entirely new form, the calculus, but then told no one about it for 27 years. In like manner he did work in optics that transformed our understanding of light, and laid the foundation for the science of spectroscopy, and again chose not to share the results for 3 decades. For all his brilliance, real science accounted for only a part of his interests. At least half his working life was given over to alchemy and wayward religious pursuits. These were not mere dabblings, but whole-hearted devotions. He was a secret adherent of a dangerously heretical sect called Arianism, whose principal tenet was the belief that there had been no Holy Trinity, slightly ironic since Newton's college at Cambridge was Trinity. He spent endless hours studying the floor plan of the lost temple of King Solomon in Jerusalem, teaching himself Hebrew in the process, the better to scan original texts, in the belief that it held mathematical clues to the dates of the second coming of Christ and the end of the world. His attachment to alchemy was no less ardent. In 1936, the economist John Maynard Keynes bought a trunk of Newton's papers at auction and discovered with astonishment that they were overwhelmingly preoccupied not with optics or planetary motions, but with a single-minded quest to turn base metals into precious ones. An analysis of a strand of Newton's hair in the 1970s found it contained mercury, an element of interest to alchemists, hatters, and thermometer makers, but almost no one else, at a concentration some 40 times the natural level. It is perhaps little wonder that he had trouble remembering to rise in the morning. Quite what Halley expected to get from him when he made his unannounced visit in August 1684, we can only guess. But thanks to the later account of a Newton confidant, Abraham de Moivre, we do have a record of one of science's most historic encounters. In 1684, Dr. Halley came to visit at Cambridge, and after they had some time together, the doctor asked him what he thought the curve would be that would be described by the planets, supposing the force of attraction toward the sun to be reciprocal to the square of their distance from it. This was a reference to a piece of mathematics known as the inverse square law, which Halley was convinced lay at the heart of the explanation, though he wasn't sure exactly how. Sir Isaac replied immediately that it would be an ellipse. The doctor, struck with joy and amazement, asked him how he knew it. "Why," saith he, "I have calculated it." Whereupon Dr. Halley asked him for his calculation without further delay. Sir Isaac looked among his papers, but could not find it. This was astounding, like someone saying he had found a cure for cancer but couldn't remember where he had put the formula. Pressed by Halley, Newton agreed to redo the calculations and produce a paper. He did as promised, but then did much more. He retired for 2 years of intensive reflection and scribbling, and at length produced his masterwork, the Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, or Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, better known as the Principia. Once in a great while, a few times in history, a human mind produces an observation so acute and unexpected that people can't quite decide which is the more amazing, the fact or the thinking of it. Principia was one of those moments. It made Newton instantly famous. For the rest of his life, he would be draped with plaudits and honours, becoming, among much else, the first person in Britain knighted for scientific achievement. Even the great German mathematician Gottfried von Leibniz, with whom Newton had a long, bitter fight over priority for the invention of the calculus, thought his contributions to mathematics equal to all the accumulated work that had preceded him. "Nearer the gods no mortal may approach," wrote Halley, in a sentiment that was endlessly echoed by his contemporaries and by many others since. Although the Principia has been called one of the most inaccessible books ever written, Newton intentionally made it difficult so that he wouldn't be pestered by mathematical smatterers, as he called them, it was a beacon to those who could follow it. It not only explained mathematically the orbits of heavenly bodies, but also identified the attractive force that got them moving in the first place, gravity. Suddenly every motion in the universe made sense. At Principia's heart were Newton's three laws of motion, which state very boldly that a thing moves in the direction in which it is pushed, that it will keep moving in a straight line until some other force acts to slow or deflect it, and that every action has an opposite and equal reaction, and his universal law of gravitation. This states that every object in the universe exerts a tug on every other. It may not seem like it, but as you sit here now, you are pulling everything around you, walls, ceiling, lamp, pet cat, toward you with your own little, indeed very little, gravitational field. And these things are also pulling on you. It was Newton who realized that the pull of any two objects is, to quote Feynman again, proportional to the mass of each, and varies inversely as the square of the distance between them. Put another way, if you double the distance between two objects, the attraction between them becomes four times weaker. This can be expressed with a formula F equals GMM apostrophe over R squared, which is, of course, way beyond anything that most of us could make practical use of, but at least we can appreciate that it is elegantly compact. A couple of brief multiplications, a simple division, and bingo, you know your gravitational position wherever you go. It was the first really universal law of nature ever propounded by a human mind, which is why Newton is regarded with such universal esteem. Principia's production was not without drama. To Halley's horror, just as work was nearing completion, Newton and Hooke fell into dispute over the priority for the inverse square law, and Newton refused to release the crucial third volume, without which the first two made little sense. Only with some frantic shuttle diplomacy and the most liberal applications of flattery did Halley manage finally to extract the concluding volume from the erratic professor. Halley's traumas were not yet quite over. The Royal Society had promised to publish the work, but now pulled out, citing financial embarrassment. The year before, the Society had backed a costly flop called The History of Fishes, and they now suspected that the market for a book on mathematical principles would be less than clamorous. Halley, whose means were not great, paid for the book's publication out of his own pocket. Newton, as was his custom, contributed nothing. To make matters worse, Halley at this time had just accepted a position as the Society's clerk, and he was informed that the Society could no longer afford to provide him with a promised salary of £50 per annum. He was to be paid instead in copies of The History of Fishes. Newton's laws explain so many things: the slosh and roll of ocean tides, the motions of planets, why cannonballs trace a particular trajectory before thudding back to Earth, why we aren't flung into space as the planet spins beneath us at hundreds of miles an hour, that it took a while for all their implications to seep in. But one revelation became almost immediately controversial. This was the suggestion that the Earth is not quite round. According to Newton's theory, the centrifugal force of the Earth's spin should result in a slight flattening at the poles and a bulging at the equator, which would make the planet slightly oblate. That meant that the length of a degree wouldn't be the same in Italy as it was in Scotland. Specifically, the length would shorten as you moved away from the poles. This was not good news for those people whose measurements of the Earth were based on the assumption that the Earth was a perfect sphere, which was everyone. For half a century, people had been trying to work out the size of the Earth, mostly by making very exacting measurements. One of the first such attempts was by an English mathematician named Richard Norwood. As a young man, Norwood had travelled to Bermuda with a diving bell modelled on Halley's device, intending to make a fortune scooping pearls from the seabed. The scheme failed because there were no pearls, and anyway Norwood's bell didn't work. But Norwood was not one to waste an experience. In the early 17th century, Bermuda was well known among ship's captains for being hard to locate. The problem was that the ocean was big, Bermuda small, and the navigational tools for dealing with this disparity hopelessly inadequate. There wasn't even yet an agreed length for a nautical mile. Over the breadth of an ocean, the smallest miscalculations would become magnified, so that ships often missed Bermuda-sized targets by dismaying margins. Norwood, whose first love was trigonometry and thus angles, decided to bring a little mathematical rigour to navigation, and to that end he determined to calculate the length of a degree. Starting with his back against the Tower of London, Norwood spent 2 devoted years marching 280 miles north to York, repeatedly stretching and measuring a length of chain as he went, all the while making the most meticulous adjustments for the rise and fall of the land and the meanderings of the road. The final step was to measure the angle of the sun at York, at the same time of day and on the same day of the year, as he had made his first measurement in London. From this, he reasoned he could determine the length of 1 degree of the Earth's meridian, and thus calculate the distance around the world. It was an almost ludicrously ambitious undertaking. A mistake of the slightest fraction of a degree would throw the whole thing out by miles. But in fact, as Norwood proudly declaimed, he was accurate to within a scantling, or more precisely, to within about 600 yards. In metric terms, his figure worked out at 110.72 kilometres per degree of arc. In 1637, Norwood's masterwork of navigation, The Seaman's Practice, was published and found an immediate following. It went through 17 editions and was still in print 25 years after his death. Norwood returned to Bermuda with his family, becoming a successful planter and devoting his leisure hours to his first love, trigonometry. He survived there for 38 years, and it would be pleasing to report that he passed this span in happiness and adulation. In fact, he didn't. On the crossing from England, his 2 young sons were placed in a cabin with the Reverend Nathaniel White, and somehow so successfully traumatized the young vicar that he devoted much of the rest of his career to persecuting Norwood in any small way he could think of. Norwood's 2 daughters brought their father additional pain by making poor marriages. One of the husbands, possibly incited by the vicar, continually laid small charges against Norwood in court, causing him much exasperation and necessitating repeated trips across Bermuda to defend himself. Finally, in the 1650s, witch trials came to Bermuda, and Norwood spent his final years in severe unease that his papers on trigonometry, with their arcane symbols, would be taken as communications with the devil, and that he would be treated to a dreadful execution. So little is known of Norwood that it may in fact be that he deserved his unhappy declining years. What is certainly true is that he got them. Meanwhile, the momentum for determining the Earth's circumference passed to France. There, the astronomer Jean Picard devised an impressively complicated method of triangulation involving quadrants, pendulum clocks, zenith sectors, and telescopes for observing the motions of the moons of Jupiter. After 2 years of trundling and triangulating his way across France, in 1669 he announced a more accurate measure of 110.46 kilometres for 1 degree of arc. This was a great source of pride for the French, but it was predicated on the assumption that the Earth was a perfect sphere, which Newton now said it was not. To complicate matters, after Picard's death, the father and son team of Giovanni and Jacques Cassini repeated Picard's experiments over a larger area and came up with results that suggested that the Earth was fatter not at the equator, but at the poles. that Newton, in other words, was exactly wrong. It was this that prompted the Academy of Sciences to dispatch Bouguer and La Condamine to South America to take new measurements. They chose the Andes because they needed to measure near the equator to determine if there really was a difference in sphericity there, and because they reasoned that mountains would give them good sight lines. In fact, the mountains of Peru were so constantly lost in cloud that the team often had to wait weeks for an hour's clear surveying. On top of that, they had selected one of the most nearly impossible terrains on Earth. Peruvians refer to their landscape as muy accidentado, much accidented, and this it most certainly is. The French had not only to scale some of the world's most challenging mountains, mountains that defeated even their mules, but to reach the mountains they had to ford wild rivers, hack their way through jungles, and cross miles of high, stony desert, nearly all of it uncharted and far from any source of supplies. But Bouguer and La Condamine were nothing if not tenacious, and they stuck to the task for 9.5 long, grim, sun-blistered years. Shortly before concluding the project, they received word that a second French team, taking measurements in northern Scandinavia, and facing notable discomforts of their own, from squelching bogs to dangerous ice floes, had found that a degree was in fact longer near the poles, as Newton had promised. The Earth was 43 kilometres stouter when measured equatorially than when measured from top to bottom around the poles. Bouguer and La Condamine thus had spent nearly a decade working toward a result they didn't wish to find, only to learn now that they weren't even the first to find it. Listlessly, they completed their survey, which confirmed that the first French team was correct. Then, still not speaking, they returned to the coast and took separate ships home. Something else conjectured by Newton in the Principia was that a plumb bob hung near a mountain would incline very slightly toward the mountain, affected by the mountain's gravitational mass, as well as by the Earth's. This was more than a curious fact. If you measured the deflection accurately and worked out the mass of the mountain, you could calculate the universal gravitational constant, that is, the basic value of gravity known as G, and along with it, the mass of the Earth. Bouguer and La Condamine had tried this on Peru's Mount Chimborazo, but had been defeated by both the technical difficulties and their own squabbling, and so the notion lay dormant for another 30 years, until resurrected in England by Neville Maskelyne, the astronomer royal. In Darvas Sobel's popular book, Longitude, Maskelyne is presented as a ninny and villain for failing to appreciate the brilliance of the clockmaster John Harrison. And this may be so, but we are indebted to him in other ways not mentioned in her book, not least for his successful scheme to weigh the Earth. Maskelyne realized that the nub of the problem lay with finding a mountain of sufficiently regular shape to judge its mass. At his urging, the Royal Society agreed to engage a reliable figure to tour the British Isles to see if such a mountain could be found. Maskelyne knew just such a person, the astronomer and surveyor Charles Mason. Maskelyne and Mason had become friends 11 years earlier, while engaged in a project to measure an astronomical event of great importance, the passage of the planet Venus across the face of the Sun. The tireless Edmund Halley had suggested years before that if you measured one of these passages from selected points on the Earth, you could use the principles of triangulation to work out the distance to the Sun, and from that calibrate the distances to all the other bodies in the solar system. Unfortunately, transits of Venus, as they are known, are an irregular occurrence. They come in pairs, 8 years apart, but then are absent for a century or more, and there were none in Halley's lifetime. The next transit will be on June the 8th, 2004, with a second in 2012. There were none in the 20th century. But the idea simmered, and when the next transit came due in 1761, nearly 2 decades after Halley's death, the scientific world was ready. Indeed, more ready than it had been for an astronomical event before. With the instinct for ordeal that characterized the age, scientists set off for more than 100 locations around the globe, to Siberia, China, South Africa, Indonesia, and the woods of Wisconsin, among many others. France dispatched 32 observers, Britain 18 more, and still others set out from Sweden, Russia, Italy, Germany, Ireland, and elsewhere. It was history's first cooperative international scientific venture, and almost everywhere it ran into problems. Many observers were waylaid by war, sickness, or shipwreck. Others made their destinations but opened their crates to find equipment broken or warped by tropical heat. Once again, the French seemed fated to provide the most memorably unlucky participants. Jean Chap spent months travelling to Siberia by coach, boat, and sleigh, nursing his delicate instruments over every perilous bump, only to find the last vital stretch blocked by swollen rivers, the result of unusually heavy spring rains, which the locals were swift to blame on him after they saw him pointing strange instruments at the sky. Chap managed to escape with his life, but with no useful measurements. Unluckier still was Guillaume Le Gentil, whose experiences are wonderfully summarized by Timothy Ferris in Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Le Gentil set off from France a year ahead of time to observe the transit from India, but various setbacks left him still at sea on the day of the transit, just about the worst place to be since steady measurements were impossible on a pitching ship. Undaunted, Le Gentil continued on to India to await the next transit in 1769. With 8 years to prepare, he erected a first-rate viewing station, tested and retested his instruments, and had everything in a state of perfect readiness. On the morning of the second transit, June the 4th, 1769, he awoke to a fine day, but just as Venus began its pass, a cloud slid in front of the sun, and remained there for almost exactly the duration of the transit, 3 hours, 14 minutes, and 7 seconds. Stoically, Le Gentil packed up his instruments and set off for the nearest port, but en route he contracted dysentery and was laid up for nearly a year. Still weakened, he finally made it onto a ship. It was nearly wrecked in a hurricane off the African coast. When at last he reached home, 11.5 years after setting off and having achieved nothing, he discovered that his relatives had had him declared dead in his absence and had enthusiastically plundered his estate. In comparison, the disappointments experienced by Britain's 18 scattered observers were mild. Mason found himself paired with a young surveyor named Jeremiah Dixon, and apparently they got along well, for they formed a lasting partnership. Their instructions were to travel to Sumatra and chart the transit there, but after just one night at sea their ship was attacked by a French frigate. Although scientists were in an internationally cooperative mood, nations weren't. Mason and Dixon sent a note to the Royal Society, observing that it seemed awfully dangerous on the high seas, and wondering if perhaps the whole thing oughtn't to be called off. In reply, they received a swift and chilly rebuke, noting that they had already been paid, that the nation and scientific community were counting on them, and that their failure to proceed would result in the irretrievable loss of their reputations. Chastened, they sailed on, but en route word reached them that Sumatra had fallen to the French, and so they observed the transit inconclusively from the Cape of Good Hope. On the way home, they stopped on the lonely Atlantic outcrop of St. Helena, where they met Maskelyne, whose observations had been thwarted by cloud cover. Mason and Maskelyne formed a solid friendship, and spent several happy and possibly even mildly useful weeks charting tidal flows. Soon afterward, Maskelyne returned to England, where he became Astronomer Royal, and Mason and Dixon, now evidently more seasoned, set off for 4 long and often perilous years surveying their way through 244 miles of dangerous American wilderness, to settle a boundary dispute between the estates of William Penn and Lord Baltimore and their respective colonies of Pennsylvania and Maryland. The result was the famous Mason and Dixon line, which later took on symbolic importance as the dividing line between the slave and free states. Although the line was their principal task, they also contributed several astronomical surveys, including one of the century's most accurate measurements of a degree of meridian, an achievement that brought them far more acclaim in England than the settling of a boundary dispute between spoiled aristocrats. Back in Europe, Maskelyne and his counterparts in Germany and France were forced to the conclusion that the transit measurements of 1761 were essentially a failure. One of the problems, ironically, was that there were too many observations, which when brought together often proved contradictory and impossible to resolve. The successful charting of a Venusian transit fell instead to a little-known Yorkshire-born sea captain named James Cook, who watched the 1769 transit from a sunny hilltop in Tahiti, and then went on to chart and claim Australia for the British Crown. Upon his return, there was now enough information for the French astronomer Joseph Lalande to calculate that the mean distance from the Earth to the Sun was a little over 150